Bruce Knapp, your host on Worldwide UFO News Radio. Strange days indeed.
Program 216 of these strange days indeed. In the co-host seat here, Bobby Rowley. Joining us now is a man for many of you who will need no introduction at all. He's the author of literally dozens of books, many of them UFO related, including the Roswell Encyclopedia, Invasion Washington, UFOs Over the Capitol, The Abduction Enigma, Spaceships of the Visitors with Russ Estes, Scientific Ufology, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, History of UFO Crashes, Project Blue Book Exposed, The Randall Report, UFOs in the 1950s, Project Moondust. It's hard to believe that this one man has written all of these and probably several dozen others. I'm talking, of course, of Kevin Randall. And Kevin, this past summer, was involved with the two-hour special that was on the Sci-Fi Channel last night, The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. Kevin, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you around again.
Well, it's good to get back to Canada.
You went into this one, the Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. Was it relatively blindly, or did you go in with eyes fairly wide open?
By the time they brought me into this thing, they had done an awful lot of the work. And from what they said to me was that every time they interviewed somebody, they said, well, you've got to talk to Kevin Randall, too. So I came into it late. I was interviewed in October for it, as opposed to last summer. So I was brought into it late, and I had a good idea of where they were going and what they were looking for by the time I got involved in it.
There were a lot of rumors over the last few weeks. Very little detail had gotten out about the content of the 2 hours. There were rumors going around about what possibly might be found. Wendy Connors this week on the UFO updates list made a prediction that they would probably find a gouge in the field there at the Foster Ranch. And in fact, it transpired that she was right. Had you any idea of what they were potentially going to reveal when you did your segments for it?
I knew in my discussions with the producers and the people I had talked to, I had a good idea what they had found and what the tone of the program would take. And then subsequently talking to them during the interview and after the interview, I was able to discern more of what was going on. So I knew when Wendy Connor made her prediction pretty much that her prediction was on the money. And some of the other things that had appeared on updates and some of the other discussion that had gone on, I also knew that some of the people had a pretty good idea. Now, I didn't know specifically, for example, what Dave Rudiak was going to say, but I knew that he had been interviewed and that he has said a number of times in the last several months that he's been able to decipher the Ramey memo, the document that General Ramey is seen clutching in his hot little fist in the pictures taken by J. Bon Johnson back in 1947. So I had an idea of what was going to be said there, and I knew what some of the interpretations of that memo were. So I figured some of that out. I had a pretty good idea of what they had learned, and I was, if not the last person they interviewed, I was certainly among the last.
Instead of among the first, because, I mean, you're one of the people that has spent an amazing amount of time on this Roswell mystery.
I think what happened was the Sci-Fi Channel representatives happened to be down in Roswell when Don Schmidt and Tom Carey were in the museum down there, and because of that, they thought that the two of them would be able to present the whole perspective for the documentary, and I think that they learned that there were things that I knew and areas that I had gone into and expertise that I had that neither one of them possessed, so it was necessary for them to talk to me about some of the things as well. I mean, I brought a different perspective to it being a military officer, so talking to former military officers, I knew the language and I knew some of the things that they said. For example, and just a quick example, everyone had said that Colonel DuBose had been Ramey's aide, General Ramey's aide, General Ramey being a brigadier general. Well, as a military officer, I knew that a brigadier general does not have a full colonel as his aide. Yeah, the chief of staff of the Air Force would have a full colonel as his aide, but a brigadier general of a numbered Air Force certainly wouldn't have that. So I knew that DuBose had a different position and discovered, of course, that he was the chief of staff, which is a much more responsible position than just that of an aide. So I was able to correct that minor error based solely on my expertise and reading of some of that. So I think that I bring that sort of perspective to the investigation that those who have no military experience simply can't bring to it.
Mm. The producers of the documentary commissioned an archaeologist from the University of New Mexico to go out and do a week's worth of rummaging around in the ground at the Foster Ranch at the alleged crash site of a UFO back in 1947. And he came up with a couple of things, didn't he?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that no matter what you think about Roswell, whether it's extraterrestrial or a Mogul balloon, everyone agrees something fell on the Foster Ranch.
Okay.
And we pretty well know that site based on the eyewitness testimony of Bill Brazel, the son of the man who found it, and Bud Payne, who also had been out there in 1947 and seen part of the debris field. So we knew, based on that eyewitness testimony, pretty much where it was. And so when they went out to do their archaeological site survey, something happened on the Foster Ranch. We knew where it happened on the Foster Ranch. I've always believed that when we looked at that, we were slightly too far to the west, maybe 500 yards too far to the west. So when they began their research, they found a gouge, the gouge that had been described by Bill Brazel and some of the other witnesses down through this area. And they had found it, but they'd found it shifted slightly to the east, and that bothered them until I pointed out that I thought that Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, and I had always placed the exact debris field a little bit too far to the west. And that brings the gouge even more closely into line with what Bill Brazel had said. They used a backhoe to dig a trench across part of the area there to see what they could find. And as they were looking down in the trench, they found the remnants of some area that had been scraped out. Now, clearly, this doesn't mean they found the gouge that was cut out by an alien spacecraft. They found some sort of an anomalous gouge in the terrain there, which was interesting because here is the point. We said, there's a gouge in this terrain, and they dug down and found a gouge. So that was kind of interesting. But there's really nothing to link it to 1947 other than eyewitness testimony that there was a gouge, and you know, there's no linkage of this particular artifact to the crash. But it is interesting that they found that and continued to study that. But they found a gouge basically where we said there should be a gouge. So you can draw your own conclusions. Now, I know that Dr. Dolman, who was the University of New Mexico archaeologist who was brought in as sort of the main guy, said it could have been caused by something else. But
yeah, he said it could have been a coyote burrow.
Or a coyote track or a cow track. By the same token, I mean, they did find a gouge, and we really don't know what caused it.
There have been some interesting comments made about this documentary. One of the grumpy old guys, probably the most grumpy UFO researcher, Herb Taylor, in a post to the Project 1947 email list said this morning that it's more than a bit discouraging that yet another farcical presentation supposedly representing serious UFO research has been foisted upon the American people. Got to get those dissenting voices in there for some reason, Kevin. Although Jerry Clark said that he saw a more interesting than usual, though predictably padded look at the Roswell incident. And I think that ufologists who were featured on the show represented us, the UFO field, well.
You know, Herb Taylor is an interesting guy and used to be one of the true supporters of the Roswell crash. And to my way of thinking, he's now gone over to the dark side.
Well, like Carl Flock.
Much like Carl Flock, who went over to the dark side. And I can understand where he's coming from, because last January I was involved in another project where this History Channel had done this thing. There was going to be the Roswell case, and they had found all these recently declassified documents. And it had a very negative spin, so I'm sure Herb Taylor would have enjoyed that one. But I think of the two, the one last night was much more honest in their presentation. And I think that's a point we have to make.
That's been the general consensus. Richard Hall said exactly the same thing on the UFO updates list today, that it was probably one of the better UFO documentaries that he's seen.
I think he's right on that point. I think that anything that puts a positive spin on the Roswell crash is going to offend Herb Taylor because he just doesn't like that sort of thing. But I think that when you look at it in its totality, that this thing was a fairly accurate and objective representation of what took place in Roswell, and there's really no way to get around that. Yes, they come to the conclusion that whatever fell there was extraterrestrial, and they did present some interesting testimonies that hadn't been heard before publicly. For example, one of Edwin Easley's daughters, Edwin Easley being the provost marshal from the 509th Bomb Group, his daughter, for the first time, is interviewed on one of these documentaries, and she brought to that program an interesting perspective of what her father said and how he reacted to this event, something that we really hadn't seen in one of these documentaries. I've known her for years, and we had actually went to dinner once in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So, I mean, we had talked to her and knew what she had to say, but it was the first time that that was brought forward, and I think that was an interesting perspective to have. And so, I mean, when you look at it in that point of view, I think they worked very hard to be objective. They worked very hard to be honest in their presentation, and in the end concluded that it may have been extraterrestrial, but the proof positive we still don't happen to have in our hot little fists.
Of course, I haven't seen the documentary, but I heard that they had found some sort of artifacts that they weren't sure what they were, and they were headed off for analysis, or was that soil samples? And I'm getting
I think
confused.
Mostly what they had were a large number of soil samples, and there may have been something contained in the soil samples. When we did the first archaeological investigation back in 1989, we took any number of soil samples thinking that no matter how carefully you cleaned the debris field, how carefully you attempted to vacuum up everything,
there must be particles there.
There would be something left, even if it was on a microscopic level. And our samples didn't reveal anything of an extraterrestrial nature, which is not to say that they may not have come up with something like that. And that takes a long time to analyze, and I'm sure that analysis is still going on. And clearly, they said as they were out on the field, Dr. Dolman found the remnants of a weather balloon. So they brought that to the forefront. Now, when I looked at it, I said, well, this clearly is not from 1947. He said it had been there for a long time because some of the local flora was beginning to grow through it and holding it to the soil. But I could tell that it wasn't a 1947 weather balloon because, frankly, a 1947 weather balloon would have disintegrated within a month.
And absolutely, yes.
But they took the thing off and they analyzed it, and the Weather Service said that it was at most 10 years old. So clearly it is not related to any of the Roswell events.
Yeah.
Looking at it, you could tell.
Do need to point out to the listeners who don't know that Roswell is in New Mexico. It's high desert. And then in the summertime, it gets unbelievably hot down there. And the sun is incredibly bright. And anything left lying around is really going to be affected by heavy-duty ultraviolet down there.
But more importantly, the neoprene rubber they were using in 1947, even if you're up in the northern latitudes, the sunlight is going to get to it and break it down fairly rapidly. But in New Mexico, in the high desert, in the summertime, of course, it's going to break down even more rapidly.
Yeah, yeah. I need to ask you, because a couple of people have asked me when they discovered that you were going to be on the program, why is Kevin Randall pulling the plug on the late Frank Kaufman, his main source for the alien bodies story?
Frankly, we discovered that Frank Kaufman can't be trusted. That's the long and the short of it. When we began the investigation, I mean, we went and found Frank Kaufman. It wasn't that Frank Kaufman came forward with this incredible tale. We went and talked to Frank Kaufman, and he provided us with, in the beginning, limited information. And as we got to know him, he expanded it and expanded it. Now, as we continued the investigation, there were some serendipitous corroborations of what Frank had to say. As a minor example, William Woody, who saw an object in the sky fall down. Now, if we go back to the original conventional wisdom that the crash took place on the evening of July 2nd, the military cordon went up on July 8th. What we have is Woody and his father seeing this event on a Wednesday night and going out to look for it the following Tuesday. But if we plugged in Frank Kaufman, then it falls on a Friday night and Woody and his father went out the next day and looked for it. And it made more sense to me that way. So a very minor and a very subtle corroboration of what Frank Kaufman said, but there were a number of those sorts of things. And as he told us more, we began to learn more about it. Unfortunately, we have now discovered that Frank Kaufman was making it up as he went along. For example, Don Schmidt said that Frank Kaufman had said that he, Kaufman, had been a colonel. Kaufman never said anything like that to me, but he did mention many, many times he'd been a master sergeant, one of the highest of the enlisted grades. When we found documentation, we discovered that Frank Kaufman had never risen above staff sergeant, we found documentation that he'd altered to prove that he'd been a master sergeant.
Yeah.
This does not speak well for the credibility of the man.
Mm-hmm.
We found other documents that he'd also altered. And given that and the fact that we found the names of the nine people, that the nine main people, he claimed there were nine people involved in the investigation, the core of nine people that had come in from Washington, D.C. And we found those nine names in his documentation, and of course they weren't anybody that he claimed they were. They were not well-trained, highly specialized group he claimed them to be.
Yeah. Does that negate the various stories about bodies that were discovered at the crash site in Roswell, New Mexico?
All it really does is negate Frank Kaufman's.
Okay. All right.
Because Edwin Easley, even though he was very circumspect in what he said, very reticent to talk about what he had seen, did mention briefly creatures. So Edwin Easley, who I have always thought is one of the better witnesses, even though who was getting information from him was akin to pulling teeth, he did indicate that sort of thing. And Edwin Easley told me flat out it was extraterrestrial. Here was a guy who would have, was in a position to know it. There are other hints of bodies, but the testimony we had that took us directly to bodies, the best testimony we had, were from people like Frank Kaufman, and that's been eliminated now. So all we've done is clarified the situation a little bit by being able to eliminate his stories from the mix, and it sort of puts us in a position where we cannot be as confident as we were about what the bodies looked like and how many there were and where they were found, but we still have information that takes us in that direction. It's just not as robust as it had been.
Mm. Dave Ferlot, who does a weekly editorial on this program, was looking at a Roswell timeline that Sci-Fi Channel has up at its website. And you can get to the Sci-Fi Channel via www.virtuallystrange.net and this program's web page there. There is mention in that timeline about a wire recording that was made of an interview with Mac Brazel. Wire recorders were the predecessors of magnetic tape recorders. Are you aware of such a recording, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely. That's been part of the Roswell story from the very beginning. Judd Roberts, who was the minority station over at KGFL Radio, said to me many times, including on videotape, that they had brought Mac Brazel from the ranch back to Roswell with a specific purpose in mind of getting a recording. And they sat him down and made a recording of an interview they conducted with him. And what they said was interesting, to rewind it took as long as it did to record it. So you don't have a fast rewind. If the interview lasted an hour, it took them an hour to rewind the wire. And then they, of course, took him out to the base for the interviews out there. But according to Judd Roberts, when it was discovered they had this recording, the New Mexico congressional delegation, the FCC, and other governmental authorities told them not to air that interview because if they did, they could all begin looking for other work because they'd be out of the radio business. So the power of the government was brought to bear on this tiny little, and I want to say 200-watt station, but I'm not sure it was quite that big back in 1947. Their coverage, according to Judd Roberts, reached almost all the outlying areas of Roswell itself. So if you were on the wrong side of town, you may not have been able to pick up the station.
Yeah, there were one or two like that in this neighborhood up until a few years ago.
So yeah, there was a wire recording made. It was not aired or broadcast, and had it been broadcast, I doubt many people in Roswell. Roswell at the time, I think even if you counted in the base population, was about 15,000 people.
Mm.
And so there wouldn't have been all that many people who would have heard the interview anyway.
Does that recording still exist, do you know?
Oh, absolutely not.
Mm.
What happened, according to Frank Joyce, who was an employee of KGFL, and he tells this alone, there is no corroborative testimony for this, that the government had come through the station, the government representatives, and picked up everything related to the Roswell crash, and owners of the station had surrendered everything, with the exception of a few teletype messages that Frank Joyce had managed to secret away. And of course, he showed them to us, and I have copies of those documents.
Mm.
So, I mean, there is some corroboration for there was stuff that came through, but there hasn't been any real corroboration. Judd Roberts tells us that the interview took place, and others suggested it had taken place, but it was never aired, and the recording no longer exists.
Mm. For the listeners who are not familiar with the Roswell story, Mac Brazel was the man who found the debris field of the downed craft.
Whatever it was,
yeah.
I believe it was extraterrestrial. Others don't follow with that. Now, they intimated on the Sci-Fi Channel last night, and this came mainly from Carey and Schmidt, that Mac Brazel had actually seen the body somewhere and that he had found the rest of the craft or an escape pod or something, and I'm just not sure that is quite right. I just can't see a point where Brazel saw that sort of thing, and his son, who I've interviewed any number of times, never hinted that his father had seen anything like that. So I don't know where they came up with that information, and heck, it may be accurate for all I know. I haven't run into that myself, although Frank Joyce, of course, talks about how Brazel, after he had been brought to the radio station a second time, he'd done an interview with Frank Joyce on Sunday evening or something like that, talking about what he had seen, and then he showed up on, I guess it would have been Tuesday evening, and gave Joyce a different story, according to what Joyce says, and Joyce mentioned something about little green men, or Brazel said, that, you know, how they talk about little green men, and that part of the story is a little bit hazy. But the point is, Brazel said, well, they're not green, implying that Brazel had seen them at some point, and we have never been able to figure out exactly how Brazel would have been in a position to see them. Once the military was involved in that, Brazel would have been excluded. They would not have brought a civilian in, so he would have had to see them prior to the government coming out. And had he seen the bodies and the escape pod prior to going into the sheriff's office, then the whole tone of that conversation would have been different. So I'm not sure exactly how this all fits together. As they say, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt suggested last night on the program that Brazel had found an escape pod as well as the debris field.
Was there anything significant that adds to the knowledge base of Roswell in the program last night?
Well, I would have thought my revelation about Frank Kaufman would have been a revelation that would have been applauded by people like Herb Taylor, for example.
Yeah.
but apparently he overlooked that part. I think their finding of the gouge was significant. I think Rudiak's interpretation of the Ramey memo, if Rudiak's interpretation is accurate, and I still think that interpretation may be open to question, and others need to see if they can come up with the same interpretation of what Dave Rudiak says. But if what Rudiak is right, then we have a document with a known provenance because General Ramey's holding it in the photograph.
Yes.
And we know when the photograph was taken, July 8, 1947, because I was able to trace the photograph through the Bettman Photo Archives, and it had a time and a date on it. So we know it was transmitted at 11:59 p.m. on July 8, 1947. So we have a document with a provenance, and if Rudiak is right in his interpretation, then that's the smoking gun in the discussions of Roswell now can cease about it being a Mogul balloon, and we can begin to determine exactly what we can about the extraterrestrial nature of it.
Thank you for joining us tonight, and thank you for all your amazing work. I really hope that somewhere in that stuff that has yet to be analyzed from the debris field, there will be something a little more conclusive for all of your work and for all of the work that everybody else has put into it.
I certainly hope they find something definitive as well, but I think they did a very nice job last night with the program.
Thank you, Kevin.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
And it's always good to have you on and good to know that you're out there.
Thank you.
And we didn't even get into the Mantell thing, but perhaps we can have you back and we'll talk about that.
We certainly can.
And we'll leave that as a mystery for people who don't know who Mantell is.
Okay.
Good night, Kevin.
Good night.
You're listening to Strange Days Indeed. We will continue with Errol Bruce Knapp on UFO News Radio, CFRB 1010.